Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, the British Constitution Group questioning the British Constitution. First, John Hurst, former Metropolitan Police officer. Then, Justin Walker, whose uncle was a governor of the Bank of England. He looks at Britain as a lawless society and what they're going to do about it. They're meeting up, a public meeting, in fact, in Winchester and also in Bristol, even before that. Also, James Files, we haven't heard from him for a while. He was the Chicago Mafia shooter that killed President Kennedy back in 1963 in Dealey Plaza. Dialect is produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. I'll give you the volunteering details at the end of the show.
My name's John Hurst. I was a PC in the Met, and it was mainly central London, but some outer. And I've been through practically every squad except child protection and traffic. But all the other squads, vehicle crime, burglary, robbery, domestic violence and so on. So I rotated through. Way back in 1964, there was a Royal Commission on Policing, and one of the conclusions was that the core function of policing is done by contented, experienced constables. And contented, experienced constables were trained by rotating them through jobs. And my generation had a choice: go for promotion or be a career constable. Not a lot of people know this, but there's not much difference in pay between a constable and a sergeant, only about £700 in the basic pay, as it then was. And in practice, a constable earns more, but he does far more overtime. So I've rotated through a number of jobs and learned how to interpret an Act of Parliament.
Okay, now I know you've had a look at Bristol City's accounts back in 2013, really 2 years after the coalition government was elected in 2010. We were told, well, we're going to have to put up with £90 million worth of cuts, which have rolled out over 3 years, about £30 million. And this year, on top of that, another £29 million. Now, I've looked at our accounts, and it's something like £350 million annual budget, which is spent by Bristol City Council. And so that means in 10 years, if these 4 years of cuts carry on, there will be no such thing as Bristol City Council, because there won't be any more money to spend. Anyway, I know you've had a look at our most recent accounts, where we're being told there's a £29 million of cuts and 1,000 job losses as a result. Now, I know you've had a look at those accounts. Can you just tell us what you've found?
Well, I've had a look at Bristol's accounts, and what I've found is there's a discrepancy between the amount that's being kept in reserve, the amount that's being collected in council tax, and the cuts. And what I've determined is that we've all heard of the budget, haven't we? The question is, how is the budget set? Well, once a year, there's a general meeting of the council, and the budget is set. But the figure is more or less given to the voting members. And the voting members rarely actually look at the whole amount of money that the council has access to. Now, there's a hidden scandal. It's called the it would appear, and if I refer you to Tony's excellent webpage and the entry on the programme that went out on the 2nd of September, there's a link to some documents that have come from America. And it would appear for the last 50 years, taxation, both national income tax and local, a large proportion of it has been siphoned off into offshore accounts. Now, this came to notice to the general public a few years ago with the Iceland banking scandal, you may recall. You might wonder, well, why have local councils got money in Iceland? Well, it wasn't just Iceland. It's a number of places around the world. Now, if you look at the links which are in the article, which I've put on Tony's webpage, you'll find that it's been calculated there's so much money invested in these accounts that the interest should be enough to run the country and run the town and run the city.
But you were saying that the interest is paying quite a lot from these offshore accounts. But I wanted to point out to you that these accounts are paying virtually zero interest now.
They appear to now, but nobody can be sure. What it appears has happened is back in 1972, there was an Act of Parliament that specified each local authority should have a senior financial person, and that's known as the Section 151 officer, because it was Section 151 of the 1972 Act. And those persons are sent on a course, and it's a course run by the Institute of Accountants. And only people that pass the course get to be Section 151 officers. Now, the problem is the syllabus that they study is a big secret. It's called a trade secret, but it's a big secret. So we can't really know what they're told to do. Now, these Section 151 officers, there's an article which I published on the UK column about them. They're supposed to be have a fiduciary responsibility, a financial responsibility, not just to the council, but to the taxpayers in each particular county. If there is a problem with funds not being taken abroad or funds not being allocated to the right use, it's these people that have got the final responsibility. And the problem is they're not talking. The UK Column's approached a number of, everyone up and down the country, every local authority, and asked them to give an account of what their unusual reserves are. And hardly any have given an account. And so we've got a problem. We've got money disappearing into unusual reserves, and it can't be accounted for, literally. Nobody understands where it's gone, what it's for.
Okay, well, we've been told here in Bristol that we've got to have 1,000 job cuts with this £29 million worth of cuts. Do you think that's justified?
I don't think 1,000 job cuts in Bristol are justified, because some of the accounts are public. And if you were to look at the accounting for 2015, for example, you'll find that there's £600 million in reserves, some of which they claim are unusable. But some of the usable reserves, for example, they've got £15 million in bonds that could be sold, bonds ready for sale, and that would address half of it. So the issue is, do your councillors know what's going on? I don't think they do, because the two gentlemen that you interviewed after the programme on the 2nd of July, the two young chaps who were councillors, it appeared to me they were waffling and they didn't know about unusual reserves. And they didn't know what was in the accounts.
Well, look, I mean, call me an idiot, John, but I would have said that you can't use unusable reserves.
Well, the issue is, what is an unusable reserve? Some local authorities, when they publish things, they reveal what an unusable reserve is. For example, I live in Paris, the Welsh county. Paris, for example, in 2013 had £300 million in reserve. They were collecting £60 million in council tax, and they were still having £27 million cuts. And that's in one of the articles which are linked to your webpage. If you were to look at the accounts for Rhondda in South Wales, you'll find that they actually say what the definition of an unusual reserve is. And they say an unusual reserve is set by regulation. Now, Rhondda came unstuck back in 2013 because two ladies who had children who reached the age of three realised there was an Act of Parliament which said that they could have 10 hours a week nursery training. And they weren't getting it because the budget had been set previously and a cut had been decided and the nursery places weren't available. These two ladies go to the Court of Queen's Bench sitting at Cardiff and they get a ruling. And the ruling basically says that there's an Act of Parliament which says that you should have these nursery places. There's a regulation that says money should be put into the reserves. An Act of Parliament always beats a regulation. It's a stronger source of law. So the ladies got their nursery place. So what I'm saying is that local authorities haven't been called to account to justify their actions by deciding to put money in reserves, relying on regulations, when they're not complying with their statutory obligations, which are more important.
Well, I would imagine that the council would say that much of this money is going, for example, to address the pension deficits and this kind of thing, and that's absolutely essential that those obligations are met, I suppose, before they're looking at what kind of public services they can extend or offer to the public in Bristol.
They might say that. I happen to know that in Paris there's a corruption issue with public sector pensions. One of the documents I found is an account of the annual general meeting of the Paris Pension Fund, and a senior councillor is quoted as making a welcoming speech to the Section 151 officer, saying, "Of course you look after us because you're in the same scheme." Now, it's a common law, a maxim of the common law, that no man may sit in judgment in his own cause. So really, it's an outrage that happened. The councillor, perhaps jokingly, saying to the Section 151 officers, "Of course you look after us." The Section 151 officer has got a fiduciary responsibility not just to the council but to everybody. So in Paris, for example, schools are being closed. There's a large school that's being closed and the locals are up in arms and the children have to be bused 20 miles and so on, just for the sake of short-term maintaining the pension scheme.
So who is the Section 151 officer for Bristol?
Well, each council has four officials that are set by Act of Parliament. One is the chief legal advisor, one's the 151, and you should be able to get that information from the website. So you'll be able to find out. If I refer you to my article on the UK column about Section 151 officers, it explains what their responsibilities are. And one of their main responsibilities is, if something unlawful is reported to have happened, they've got a duty to investigate it, and they've got powers to investigate it, and they should report it to the councillors. And they're in a special position, the 151 officer, because they can only be sacked by a resolution of the whole council. And that's supposed to be a protective mechanism so that they can be fearless in their investigations.
Okay, so what about the cuts? Do we really need these £29 million worth of cuts in Bristol?
It's like this. Every official has got a responsibility, and the responsibility is set by common law, statute or regulation. And if they step outside common law, statute or regulation, they're a member of the public and they're a criminal. So if these cuts can't be justified because there is money in reserve, then it's a common law offence of misconduct in office, and they should be called to account through the criminal courts. One of the things that the UK Column and the British Constitution Group have been doing is researching how to do that. And I refer to their websites when they have some type of information we come across. But the first stage is everybody's entitled to know where this money's gone. And if your local councillor doesn't understand it, he should find out. And if an official tries to hide where the money's gone, he should do something about it. And of course, the example of the two young chaps who were on your programme a couple of weeks ago, it was completely over their heads. They didn't know. So what I suggest is that those that are living in Bristol start asking the right questions. And the right question is, what are these reserves for? Who said they could be there? And by what statutory or common law authority are they there? And then you call them to account for their actions. It really is as simple as that.
What sorts of reasons might councils have vast amounts of money in reserves? Because I know just in the 1 year, we've had £150 million extra appearing in the reserves.
Well, going back to the beginning of this conversation, we talked about this plot. And technically, it's a fascist plot, because the definition of fascism is government and big businesses working together. Money's been extracted, it would appear. It's been invested, and the returns never come back to the originators, the taxpayer. And as you mentioned, perhaps the profit's not coming back either now. And it's been hidden away, but of course we're in the age of the internet and these things can be revealed. So if I refer you to the confidential annual financial report videos, you'll be able to do your own research and start asking some more questions.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Justin Walker, and I suppose my journey started back in 1972, a long time ago. I was going back to school. I was on a train. I was with my uncle, and he was Sir Harry Pilkington, later Lord Pilkington, and he went to the very first Bilderberg conference in 1954. I didn't know that until only a few years ago, but I did know he was the director of the Bank of England from 1955 to 1972, and this was 1972, and he was actually going back. He was travelling down to London to go to one of his last meetings at the Bank of England. And we were just talking about general subjects when he suddenly stopped me dead and said, what are you doing when you leave school? And I was only 16, and I was going down to do my O-levels and stuff. And he said, I'm going to give you two pieces of advice to take through life. First of all, never believe anything you read in the press, because we control it. And secondly, never ever believe a politician when they say they can do something, because they can't unless we say they can. So to put it bluntly, that most of that just went right over my head, but you remembered that conversation. So years to come, I joined the Green Party because I was influenced by people like Jack Cousteau and David Attenborough and all the people who, you know, at that time, Peter Scott, saying that the ecology of the world was being damaged and we had to, you know, humanity had to give nature a chance, and we had to come up with political ideas to help the environment, and I certainly, it all sounded very sensible to me. And I joined the Ecology Party, as it was then, back in 1978 I joined. And I left the Green Party in 1992, but just 4 years before doing so, I met David Icke, and he was he joined the Green Party and we became good friends. And then when he went on his big journey, as they say, his turquoise period, whatever you want to call it, I felt comfortable with quite a lot of the stuff he was saying. But really, it came back all the time to, well, I kept thinking to myself, well, how is it that we are allowing the corporate world, the big business, to basically dominate the affairs of humanity. Now, I became, as you know, Tony, as I first met you, I became involved in the 9/11 truth movement. And we realised that the war on terror was completely bogus, and we've been analysing all that. But it was about 5 years ago, almost now, I got a phone call out of the blue from somebody who said that he was a, well, he was his son, actually. It was his son talking to me, because he said his father was extremely elderly. And he said that his father had been a director of the Bank of England with my uncle. And he, not long for this world, but he wanted to tell me one word for me to research. And if I did, I would find all the answers to Britain's economic woes. And the word was Bradbury. Then he said Bradbury Pound, which helped a bit. And so the phone, you know, he said goodbye. The phone, I couldn't trace who the phone call was. I was left wondering who this Bradbury was. I eventually got my computer working, fed in the word Bradbury, and I found the guy who created the Martian Chronicles, wrote the Martian Chronicles, and then I found, what was it, that Julia Bradbury or someone, the lady walking around the countryside or something. And eventually I came across a book by Thomas Johnston called The Financiers and the Nation, and then I discovered all about the Bradbury Pound and the fact how the Treasury, to avoid a run of the banks in 1914, created, not the Bank of England, but the Treasury, created debt-free, interest-free money that was based entirely on the nation's credit and potential, and that it was a great success, stopped the banks from collapsing at the outbreak of the First World War, and effectively it was going to mean that we could have fought the First World War without actually fighting any, sorry, without incurring any major debts. But that was overturned. David Lloyd George, the Chancellor of Exchequer, as he was then, he caved in to the central bankers. And so they went back to borrowing money from the private financial sector. But that's how I became involved with, if you like, what we call sovereign national credit. And so, as I said, I've been involved in this quite a long time. But it's really now that the whole thing's coming to a head.
Well, what makes you say that? I thought the point of collision was 2008, Justin.
The point of what, sorry?
The point of collision, where the government suddenly came into a massive collision with the bankers, who then told the government, well, I'm very sorry, but unless you bail us out, the monetary system, the cash points will all close tomorrow.
Right, well, I think the first thing we've got to say is that the elite politicians are in total, well, they're just useful idiots to the central bankers and to the whole banking system. Banks do not run out of money. banks create money as and when they wish to create it. And what was very helpful was that the Bank of England actually admitted this in a journal. And in fact, I've got it here because it's absolutely crucial to the argument. It says here, now this is going back to a quarterly bulletin produced in the spring of 2014. And, quote, it says, in the modern economy, most money takes the form of bank deposits. But how those bank deposits are created is often misunderstood. The principal way is through commercial banks making loans. Whenever a bank makes a loan, it simultaneously creates a matching deposit in the borrower's bank account, thereby creating new money. In other words, creating money completely out of thin air. If you and I tried that, we'd be arrested for fraud. Now, that, you know, that is the premise, that is the whole basis of modern-day banking. Now, I'm not an economist. I've come into this, if you like, as an ordinary human being with my eyes wide open, and you realise very quickly that the banks are dictating all events. So this whole, the 2008 collapse was completely orchestrated. And we're on red alert. In fact, I've got a document inside me from Business Insider. Red alert, get ready for a severe fall in the stock market, HSBC says. The thing we've all got to realise is that the private central banking world is a law unto itself. It can create as much money as it needs and takes as much money out of the system. If it collapses the system, it will then cry, help, 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 and then our taxpayers' money is then taken to bail them out. The whole financial system is one almighty scam. And the central hub of this scam is an organisation that only 1% of the country, if that, has ever heard of. We've all heard of the OECD, the IMF, the World Bank. We've all heard of the individual central banks, the European Central Bank, Bank of England, Federal Reserve, etc. But if you say to people, the Bank for International Settlements, I know you, Tony, know about it, and certainly the researchers of this whole money scam know about it, but your average punter out there has never heard of it. And the Bank for International Settlements controls 60 central banks, including the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England. And it controls overseas 95% of the world's money. And about once every 6 to 8 weeks, there's a meeting of the top central bankers. But they don't decide anything. They merely act as conduits. They get their instructions from the big banking dynasties, the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, and the Rockefellers, and the people who ultimately pull the financial strings of the entire planet. It is an absolute scam from top to bottom, and we are all allowing it to happen because nobody bothers to ask the simple question, how is money created and by whom?
Now, you mentioned this Bradbury pound. It does sound like a good idea if the government can just create its own money and start spending that when it starts running out. So is there a potential to have a kind of new Bradbury pound?
Total potential. In fact, if this collapse, we're reckoning that, we've been reckoning for the last 2 years, but certainly all the signs are with the derivatives bubble, and the derivatives bubble is something like $4 quadrillion dollars or something hovering over the... what the hell is derivatives? I've tried to work it out, and I'm afraid that my mind just goes, I can't understand
it. Well, I'll tell you what derivatives are. It's a simple word for it, and that is casino chips.
Yeah, gambling. Oh, I couldn't agree more. Gambling, that's all it is. But the whole thing is a derived debt bubble or sword of Damocles hanging over the entire human economy, the world's economy. And, of course, when they unleash it, they can drown, they can cause total chaos and cause a collapse that will make 2008 look like the proverbial teddy bear's picnic. And so what we're up against is the potential of a major, major collapse, something on the 1929 model or the 2008 model. But if the government was a lawful government, if the government was a government of the people, serving the people, they would immediately, electronically, kick in a Bradbury pound, a new Bradbury pound, which basically means the Treasury creating and issuing all the money required by the nation's economy, so we all be prosperous and happy and secure. They can literally, in a matter of seconds, trigger, underpin the entire lawful economy, and I think the emphasis must be on the word lawful, and by that I mean people's savings, pensions, people's, ownership of property and whatever, normal shareholders in companies. In other words, all what we call the legal, legitimate and lawful part of the economy. But where the banks have run amok with their QE and their derivatives and everything else, all that, you can just say, well, you can collapse as much as you like because it's not going to affect the rest of the nation because we are now underpinned by the wealth and potential of the British nation. And currently, this is very roughly, but our potential is our labour, and that's valued at $17 trillion. And then I think our infrastructure and everything else is valued at something like $7 trillion. In total, we are worth about £24-25 trillion. And you would probably only need to harness around about, the guys who have been tipping me off quietly behind the scenes, and I think they've also been tipping Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell off because the same figure has come up. The British economy needs an injection of around about £500 billion, half a trillion pounds, for the infrastructure, the NHS, the elderly, all the vulnerable people in our society, our security, our all that side of things, and obviously job creation as well. But the most important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is we return ourselves to a more human-scale economy and we break away from this ridiculous treadmill that the big multinational companies and the bankers have put us onto, where we have mass, mindless production to meet mass-minded consumerism, and all we're doing is chasing our tails faster and faster and faster and feeding the 1%. And the 99%, the rest of us, see very little benefit from any of it.
Now, look, you said, hang on, Justin, because...
rat race that is an entire creation of the central bankers.
Now, Justin, you've said that this is a world kind of conspiracy where the banking families... But you really just talked about the Western world. Surely Russia is actually not really part of this. And also, of course, the Chinese, the last couple of years, have created their own development bank to sort of rival the IMF, etc.
Don't be taken in by the BRICS. Don't be taken in by any of that. My insider informants have told me quite categorically, if Russia and China and the others were genuinely independent and going to do something that was wonderful for the human race, why are their central banks still part of the Bank for International Settlements? No, don't be taken in by that. And remember, our global masters, our finance, you know, the New World Order, I think everyone likes to call it, they view China as the perfect working model for the rest of us.
So what about other areas of...
disappear.
What about other areas of the elite? Obviously, the bankers, the banksters, as we've started to call them, are criminals. What are the other key elements of this New World Order?
Well, one of the things, this is one reason why this conference is coming up in Winchester and what we're having also in Bristol. Another way, apart from a sovereign government taking back its absolute rightful control of its own debt-free, interest-free money based on the wealth of the nation, the other extremely important aspect to taking down the elite is to be in complete control of politicians. Politicians should be our servants. And in fact, this is one of the big, again, a big scam going on. The most important thing we can have for our freedom and for everyone's freedom is to make sure that every trial that you have is trial by jury. And one of the things that people don't realize, rather just very similar to not knowing about the Bank for International Settlements, one of the things that a jury can do is annul, basically unjust legislation passed by Parliament. Let's get one thing absolutely straight. Parliament does not pass laws. Parliament likes to think they pass laws, but in fact they pass statutes. They pass acts of Parliament, statutes. These are legal. Now, it means that a jury, if somebody is tried because they have breached a statute or whatever it may be, and the jury says, well, hang on a moment, we believe, unanimously, we believe that this statute is unjust, we will find the individual not guilty, and in doing so, we annul the effectiveness of that statute. In other words, what we're talking about is a jury is the ultimate defense and shield against tyranny. Now, we are unfortunately stuck with a political party system. One of the unfortunate things about political parties is that the most flawed and treasonous politicians get to the top. And these are the ones who are controlled by, in Britain's case, the City of London and everything else. I mean, how many people now, listening to us now, know about the City Remembrancer? Do you know about it, Tony?
Well, I've heard of the Remembrancer. What? No, I don't really.
No, exactly. Again, one of these things that hardly anyone knows anything about, including some of our own politicians who are sitting in the chamber with him.
Well, tell us.
The City of Remembrance, this position goes back to 1570, so it's an ancient position. And the City of Remembrance is the only individual who can sit with our politicians, our elected members of Parliament, okay, plus the officers of the chamber and the Speaker. But he sits with our MPs alongside them. He can mingle with them, do what he likes. And he is representing the interests of the City of London. By that, of course, I don't mean the city, the capital city. I'm talking about the financial centre itself, the City of London. And, of course, everyone thinks, oh, well, this is nice and traditional, a bit like the Lord Mayor's Parade, you know, where you see lots of floats representing local communities, you have the Territorial Army, you have people dressed up in English Civil War, you've got the nice, friendly Lord Mayor doffing his or her tricorn hat, and it all looks very magnificent and very British. And, of course, that is the wonderful mask they have to disguise what's really going on, and that is the City of London is the driving hub of the entire world's economy, and it's all based on creating money out of thin air as debt, plunging nations into debt, plunging communities into debt, plunging families into debt, because they've taken upon themselves the right to create and issue all the money required for the human economy. Now, as I said, the Remembrancer is sitting there in Parliament alongside our representatives, and he puts pressure on any MP who dares to question how money is created and by whom, and who dares to raise the issues, as I've just been raising, about the fact the whole central banking system controls the world's money.
But hang on a minute. Look, just a minute, Justin, because we did actually have a debate in the House of Commons either earlier this year or last year, I think, about money creation, didn't we?
Yes, and it was pathetic. I watched the whole thing live. There were 26 MPs out of our 650 MPs. Only 26 bothered to turn up. Not one of them mentioned the Bank for International Settlements. Not one of them mentioned that the whole money creation is out of thin air. Nobody bothered to look, and it was after the that report I mentioned that the Bank of England actually admitted they created money out of thin air. Nothing was touched whatsoever. It was about the most useless debate you could ever have heard.
So anyway, what are you doing in Winchester?
Basically, I'm the campaign coordinator for the British Constitution Group. We work with the UK column. And we've been saying for some time we've got to basically put the British Constitution back on the map, and we've got to start to show people that, well, what it is, we've got a book written by a guy called Ken Dewdney, and it's a fantastic book, and it's basically called, and I've got it here in front of me, Democracy Defined, the Manifesto. And what he makes plain is that we have got to restore the right of jury to every trial, and that every jury knows that it has the ultimate right to reject bad legislation, bad statutes. As I said, that's the ultimate shield we have against tyrannical politicians. And at the same time, to restore sovereign national credit, that is, nations. And bear in mind, the Bradbury Pound was just the British version. In America, they had the greenback dollar. And before that, that was Abraham Lincoln. Before that, in 18th century colonial America, the colonists, each of the different colonies, issued paper money called colonial scrip, which again was just paper money created and issued by the individual state, and was based on the wealth of the nation. And the City of London, of course, couldn't make any money out of it. And so they tried to impose the gold standard onto them, and to the old-fashioned ways of taking out loans, i.e. creating money out of thin air, etc. And that was the real reason for the American War of Independence. When you actually look at the whole system of money creation, you soon realise there have been many brave souls who have tried to do something about it. I mean, John F. Kennedy issued Executive Order 1110 when, just before he was assassinated in 1963... he authorised the US Treasury to base money, to create money based on silver gilt stocks they held, bypassing the Federal Reserve. And that made him deeply unpopular with the big financial, you know, families.
Now, so what about, when is this event, in Winchester? When is the event in Winchester happening?
Right, the event itself is happening. The one in Winchester is happening on November the 19th, Saturday, November the 19th, and it's at the Guild Hall, and we've got seats for, I think it's about 500, 600 people already. About a third of those seats have gone, so the event is going very well. Tickets are £10 if you buy online, and you just go onto the British Constitution website, the BCG, British Constitution Group website, and you can book your ticket there, or you can come on the day and the tickets are £20. But at the moment, it's heading to be hoping for a full house. It looks that way at the moment.
Well, you also mentioned Bristol. Obviously, yes, people here might Bristol, not want to go so far.
They've got the Bristol group. They're setting up their own special little group, which is what we're encouraging, what we're trying to do. And this is not a British Constitution group trying to be empire builders or anything. We're simply saying to every town, every city, every village, you know, people who are concerned about the Constitution, they want to restore Magna Carta to the full precedence. You know, Magna Carta, the Great Charter, which guarantees under Article 39 that you are tried by a jury. Different aspects to Magna Carta protect all aspects of our freedoms. And what we're saying to people is just start your own little groups. It doesn't have to be called British Constitution Group or anything like that. You just do your own thing and raise awareness that we are allowing tyrannical politicians backed by central bankers to impose a tyranny on all of us, and that we are heading straight forward for something, or we've called it the New World Order, but whatever you want to call it, it's a corporate tyranny. It's basically the corporate mindset forming some sort of Orwellian future for all of us where our individual freedoms count for nothing. So the Bristol Group, they are meeting on Saturday the 29th of October, and they're going to have a list of speakers. I shall be there. And I believe it's at the Watershed. Now, I don't know Bristol very well, but it's at the Watershed. And I think the time they want to start is about 6 o'clock in the evening.
Fantastic. But look, you mentioned this Bradbury Pound. This is, I always love all this hidden history, important stuff that we're not taught in school, etc. Yeah. Who or where is Bradbury?
Bradbury is Sir John Bradbury, later Lord Bradbury. Now, Sir John Bradbury was the first secretary to the Treasury at the outbreak of the First World War. So when they created these notes, and the first batch of notes were issued on stamp paper, and they were only printed on one side only. They had a black one representing £1, and they had a red note representing 10 shillings, 50 pence. And effectively, these notes were printed in the space of 3 days. They managed to pass an act through Parliament and get this money into the bank. And so by August the 7th, August the 3rd, they declared war. August the 7th, to stop a run of the banks, people accepted this paper money instead of taking out gold. And Sir John Bradbury signed the note. And that's why the notes became known as Bradbury's.
He must have had to sign quite a lot.
Well, it's the cashier's signature, the old printed signature. But what was interesting is that I literally just showed you how every day something different turned up. Somebody gave me a punch book from 1914, and somebody had written a poem, or someone in Punch had written a poem thanking Sir John Bradbury for his wonderful Bradbury notes. And as I said, it's a perfect way to fund your government and to fund all the things needed by your government without having to borrow a single penny from the private bankers.
Now, look, 2008, people talk about it as the crash. Of course, it wasn't a crash. That's disinformation or lies. Actually, it was a bailout of the banks. What would a crash really look like?
Well, whatever they've got planned, the next thing they've got planned is a bail-in.
Just explain what a bail-in is.
Well, a bail-in is very simple. The bank makes up the rules, because one of the first things you have to realise, and I'm speaking as a layman here, I'm not speaking as an economist or anything like that, but effectively, money, your money in your bank account is not your money, it's the bank's money. That is their legalese, that is under the legal side of things, it's not actually your money. And what they're now talking about is bail-ins, and they experimented this in Cyprus, when Cyprus the Greek part of Cyprus went belly up, and effectively, they're going to take money out of your account, and obviously it depends on how much money you actually have in the account, but again, they'll make up all the rules, so you won't have any say of it. And effectively, they will take a percentage of your money to pay for their debts. Well, of course, as I said before at the beginning, the banks create money completely out of thin air. They can decide how much they want. They can create as much as they want. So this idea that you know, they suddenly have no money and they need your money to bail themselves out is absolute rubbish. It's a total scam. Every aspect to the international financial world and banking world is a complete, utter scam.
So was Jesus right to throw the money changers out of the temple?
I think he was. You know, if we go along with that side of things, that was the only time that Jesus displayed any violence. And I think when dealing with the banks, we all feel the same way.
OK, look, Justin, how do we follow your work and the British Constitution Group?
Right, well, we have the UK column has the UK column has been going now for about 10 years. That's run by Brian Gerrish and Mike Robinson. They have a program that goes out every day at 1 o'clock for 1 hour, which analyzes the news, and that's online. And that's at www.ukcolumn.org. And then you have the British Constitution Group. Now, the best thing is just feed into a search engine, British Constitution Group, because we have two or three websites. We're just actually upgrading the website. But if people want to get tickets for the Winchester event, all they've got to do is go on either the UK Column website, look under events, or go onto the British Constitution Group main site, and you'll see there Winchester. Click on that, and people can buy their tickets online.
Just remind us of the dates in Winchester and Bristol, please.
Right. The Winchester event is November the 19th. That's on a Saturday. It's all day. Starts at 11 o'clock on the dot, finishes at 6 o'clock, and then we're going to go across to all the pubs and talk things through, get little groups set up and what have you. The reason why we're meeting in Winchester is because that is the old capital of England. Alfred the Great was otherwise known as Alfred the Lawgiver, and the famous statue of him is outside, literally overlooking the Guildhall. So we chose Winchester deliberately because outside London we thought that was the best place to start the Restoration Amendment, the restoration of the rule of law, and that's all it is, because we currently live in a completely lawless state. And another issue, a very important issue we haven't mentioned, is child abuse and what's going on there. And again, thanks to the sterling work of the UK Column and others, we are exposing paedophile rings which go right up to Parliament. So this is another very unpleasant aspect to the control, the way the central banking controls. They're useful idiots in Parliament and in the judiciary and everywhere else. This probably explains why we have so many of these wretched paedophile rings operating, involving the great and good of our society. And it's pretty obnoxious. And the evidence that we've uncovered absolutely appalls. And if anyone wants to see something ongoing, there's a Doherty case. If you go online and go to the UK column, click on the Doherty case, you will be absolutely appalled by it all. But that's, as I said, that's another side to the whole thing that we're campaigning on. Now, so that is the Winchester one. And then the Bristol one is on the end of this month, Saturday 29th of October. And that is taking place at the place called the Watershed. And I believe it starts at 6 p.m.
Finally, going back to Bradbury again, do you actually have a Bradbury pound yourself?
I don't. I know a friend who has, but to buy one, you're costing you about, I think they're going on the, well, I believe the price has gone up since we've restored the interest in the reason for the Bradbury, but I think one would cost you now something in the region of £500, £600, £700 to buy.
Okay, well, maybe an interesting investment. Might be worth more than an ordinary pound.
Well, put it this way, as I said, electronically, you can have a Bradbury, the principle of sovereign national credit. It can kick in seconds. If the Chancellor of the Exchequer was so-minded, and he was a genuine patriot as opposed to traitor, because I'm afraid and you can safely say that Theresa May, our new Prime Minister, she spent, was it 6 years as Home Secretary or whatever? And quite simply, she was assembling the Orwellian state with GCHQ and all the other ways and means of monitoring our daily lives and monitoring what we're saying and what we're up to and et cetera. And we see now that the police force, you know, they've got Police Scotland, they've experimented there, and gradually we're going to see our police forces, the constabularies around the country, being merged and made into bigger units and so forth. So all along the line, we can see this Orwellian future for all of us as the treasonous ones in Parliament and elsewhere in the City of London basically devise their corporate world where the common law, the law of the land, the rule of law no longer applies. What we have are masses, hundreds if not thousands of statutes which are designed to control our lives, micromanage our lives. Under common law basically says you can do as you please, until you actually affect the well-being of somebody else, until you start to affect somebody else in a negative way. And that's where the cutoff comes. And that's why the common law is superior, because your peers judge your actions, whether they were reasonable or unreasonable. It is the ultimate way to protect yourselves from going anywhere near tyranny, is to have ordinary people decide what is best for all of us, and the randomly selected people with no vested interest.
Now, look, you mentioned digital there for a minute. It makes me think about Bitcoin. I wonder what you make of that.
No,
and also,
no,
there's
no,
something else, isn't there?
To do with Bitcoin or any of these ghastly things. Again, my insiders tell me that these were ultimately started by the, shall we say, they are part of the overall. I don't understand nothing. I'm going to admit my whole hands up, but I would just say this, that the actual trail of where Bitcoin everything comes back is starting to go back to the central banking system. So I just urge people, please be very wary indeed. The only true way is for a sovereign nation that is entirely accountable to the electorate, creates issues and controls the amount of debt-free, interest-free money that is needed for the happiness, security, and prosperity of that nation. And it's as simple as that. And you use, if there's too much money in the system, you then use taxation to take any inflationary heat out of the economy. And just to let you know, that this all the information, as I say, I'm no expert, but I have got a team of people, and some of them are insiders who keep us informed from the inside, as I was with the original phone call that advised me about the Bradbury. So this is coming out from people who are friends, if you like, on the inside, who want to see the central bankers defeated.
Well, I think after listening to that, we all should want to see them defeated too. Thanks very much, Justin Walker, for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
When US President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, everybody wondered why. The blame was pinned onto Lee Harvey Oswald, but later it transpired that he was just a patsy. In fact, he was murdered to keep him quiet just after the assassination. So who really did it and why? Well, James Files knows, because he fired the fatal shot that killed President Kennedy that day. You might find that surprising, but there's been several attempts on James Files' life over the years, so he decided to speak out a few years ago to a Dutch guy, Wim Dankbar. What he said was that the Chicago Mafia was sent down to kill Kennedy by the FBI, the CIA, providing cover. And Charles Nicoletti, his friend, was with a gun in the Daltech building behind the motorcade. He fired the first few shots, which didn't actually kill Kennedy. He just slumped forward. But James Files was the man that fired the fatal shot. We've been having excerpts from this interview with James Files over the last 6 months or so here on Dialect. And here's the latest one. Here he talks about what happened after Kennedy had been killed.
Do you have any idea about the possibility of other hit teams in the Plaza that day?
I've heard different stories about different teams there, different people shooting, this and that. To my knowledge only, I never knew of another hit team that was in the area for Kennedy that day. If there's another team there, I have no knowledge of it whatsoever.
But it could be.
Anything is possible. Anything's possible. There could have been another team there, but what I'm stating is this. As far as I know, from what I was involved in, Charles Nicoletti, Johnny Roselli was with him, because Johnny Roselli was like his lookout, whatever, pick up any shell casing that he ejects from the rifle. We don't want to leave shell casings on the floor. Mr. Nicoletti didn't want to be running around looking behind chairs or desk. Where's the casing? Where's the casing? You got somebody there picking them up as they come out. And like I say, I never saw Charles Nicoletti pull the trigger. But he was the shooter, from what I understand, with him.
You saw Richard Kane there. Could he have been a shooter?
Richard Kane, he was on location, and so was a guy by the name of Milwaukee Phil. His name is Philip Alarezo. Believe me, Alarezo. But if there was another hit team, because they faded from the scene, I don't honestly know. I can't say yes, I can't say no.
Do you think Lee Harvey Oswald fired any shots that day?
Lee Harvey Oswald never fired a shot. And if anybody knows what a parapin test does, and we have actual court documents on where Lee Harvey Oswald was given a parapin test by the Dallas Police Department, and on this document it plainly states, deceased J.D. Tibbett, deceased John F. Kennedy, suspect Lee Harvey Oswald. And he took a parapin test, his face, his hand, his arm, I guess the side of his neck, and the only trace of any nitrous from powder burns or powder suspicions was in the palm of his hand. And anybody that goes to a firing range that fires weapons knows if you fire a .38 revolver or any type of revolver, the blow bite is going to come back across this part of your hand and your wrist. The only reason he had those nitrous in the palm of his hand is he was holding spent shell casings when I calibrated the scope. There were still traces of that. But Lee Harvey Oswald, it's like I say, that's a court document. And I don't believe anybody rigged that one up.
So you left Mr. Nicoletti and Roselli off at this gas station where they had a car. Do you remember what that kind of car it was?
I don't know. I'm not even sure which one it was. There was a car there. I mean, they said they had a car there, but there's several cars parked up on the side. I did not wait. I did not watch them walk across the lot. As I pulled out from the intersection, I made a left-hand turn at the intersection. I went down by the gas station. When I pull up at the gas station to let them out of the car, let them out of the Chevy I'm in. And I'm in 63 Chevy, burgundy Chevy. We'll get that fact straight. Not a red one. It's just burgundy. That's the color of the car. They opened the door of the exit. As Mr. Nicoletti exited the car, just as he closed the door, he said, Jimmy, I'll see you in Chicago. Told him, okay, boss. He closed the door. They walked across as I would like to go into the park, into the gas station there. There are several cars parked over there. I have no idea, no knowledge, which particular car they went to. I did not wait to see. I pulled out, made a right, went on down, got up on the highway. I went back to Mesquite. I went back to my motel. I don't want to be riding around with a carload of weapons and somebody's just been hit. It'd be highly impractical. I went back to the hotel, pulled in. I parked my car right in front of my room where I could watch it. I got out of the car. I went into my room. When I got in the room, Zita went in, sat down, relaxed, got a drink of water, stripped all my clothes off, went in, took me a shower. Come out of the shower, I took some wax that I'd brought along for this particular purpose. And if anybody wants to try this, it can be pretty painful. But I knew that I would have redstone on me here and on the side of my face from firing the weapon and across my hand and wrist. Took hot wax and I poured it on myself and let it cool so it cut into the pores on the side of my face. And after a few minutes, I peeled it off, which would remove all the nitrous from any gunpowder. I went back into the shower and showered again, then showered, finished up with a good cold one because it felt like I was kind of on fire and burning. When I got out of the shower, dried off, then I put a lotion on everything to cool the burning sensation, and then I got dressed. Once it got dark, I went out to the car. Nobody was around. Make sure everybody was inside doing whatever they're doing in their motel rooms. Opened the trunk up. I took the weapon out of the trunk, and when I'd gotten out of the car earlier, I'd taken the briefcase, the gun case, from my fireball, and already taken that into the hotel. I went inside, had one weapon I took in, cleaned it, got it ready to put back in the car. I waited till after midnight. I went back out to the vehicle, got in, pulled the back seat out, took the top part off the back, put the gun case, the gun back in the rack, the rifle. I secured my fireball, put the gun case in there, closed everything back up, and went back in the hotel.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, John Hurst and Justin Walker from the British Constitution Group. Also to James Files, the shooter of President Kennedy, along with Charles Nicoletti and Tony Roselli from the Chicago Mafia. Also thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, or prsc.org.uk. Also through Volunteering Bristol on volunteerbristol.org.uk. Also the National Volunteering website, we're on there too at do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Bye for now.
like you to have me frozen too. And waiting still as fresh in your flesh for my return to earth. But your father refused to sign the forms to freeze you. Let's see, you'd be about 60 now and long dead by the time I return to earth. All my time-held dreams were full of you, as you were when I left. Still underage, your android replica is playing up again. It's no joke, when she comes, she moans another's name. That's the spirit of the age. 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 Ah, the spirit of the age. That's the spirit of the age. Ah, the spirit of the age. That is the spirit of the age. My flesh and bone is identical to the others. Everything I say is in the same tone as my distant brother's voice. There is no choice between us. If you had ever seen us, you'd rejoice in your uniqueness and consider every weakness something special of your own. Being a clone, I have no flaws to identify. But this dog roll that falls from my pen has just been written by another 20 telepathic men. All word for word says, oh, for the wings of any bird other than a battery hen. That's the spirit of the age. 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 It's just the spirit of the age. It's just the spirit of the age.
Spirit of the age. Spirit of the age.